From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. On today's Fresh Air, creating schools in East Harlem where students are curious, involved, and held accountable for their education. We talk with educator Deborah Meyer, the director and creator of Central Park East Secondary and Elementary Schools and recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Genius Award. Also, writer, director, and sometimes actor Harold Ramis. He's been just as influential, but not as visible as his comedy cohorts Dan Aykroyd, Chevy Chase, and Bill Murray. He recently directed Groundhog Day, now out on video. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Man Without a Face, starring and directed by Mel Gibson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. NASA scientists now say transistors aboard the Mars Observer may have caused loss of contact with the spacecraft. If it's true, they say it is a non-recoverable situation. Officials say the same kind of electronic components were blamed for a pre-launch failure on a weather satellite that is now also lost in space. In New York City, Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman pleaded not guilty today to conspiracy charges, alleging he was the mastermind of a series of terrorist plots that included the World Trade Center bombing and the plan to bomb several New York City landmarks. NPR's Maria Hinojosa reports.
The blind sheikh was the last of the 15 alleged suspects led into the courtroom this afternoon. Rahman was seated by three U.S. marshals, who then helped the sheikh put on earphones. The entire court proceedings were interpreted into Arabic for the sheikh and several other suspects. There was tight security in and around the courthouse. In a rare move, everyone allowed into the courtroom had to pass through a metal detector. But there were only a few supporters of the suspects attending the arraignment. During the uneventful hearing, the sheikh looked down at his lap and showed no emotions. He, like the other 14 who are charged in this sweeping conspiracy that now ties the World Trade Center bombing and the plot to bomb several New York landmarks, were let out after the hour-long hearing in handcuffs. Prosecutors said this trial, which could begin next year, might last well over 4 months. In New York, this is Maria Hinojosa.
America's ambassador to the United Nations said today the UN Security Council has decided to lift the oil embargo and economic sanctions against Haiti. Madeleine Albright says the council intends to take a formal vote tomorrow to lift the embargo. She said the action is expected because of the confirmation of Prime Minister Robert Malval. A baby who was electrocuted in his hospital bassinet this week may have died from human error. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is investigating. NPR's Jackie Leiden reports.
The baby, 12-day-old Stratton Vassilakos, was electrocuted on Monday at Christ Hospital in suburban Oak Lawn, Illinois, when a nurse apparently plugged his monitor into a direct power source and not specially designed power cables. The Cook County Medical Examiner said tests conducted on the unit blame human error. The Food and Drug Administration, which is also investigating the baby's death, issued safety alerts in the mid-1980s after similar incidents. The monitor's manufacturer, Corometric Medical Systems, said the unit was designed last year and came with safety cables which apparently weren't used. The baby died when about 120 volts of electrical current were attached to his chest for several minutes, causing burns and seizures. I'm Jackie Leiden in Chicago.
CBS today reportedly reached an agreement with Comcast Cablevision that will allow the third largest cable company to continue to retransmit CBS programs free to its subscribers. The deal is said to call for Comsat to pay a nominal amount to CBS to create a new cable channel. On Wall Street, the Dow is down almost 4 points. This is NPR News. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Henry Cisneros was in Des Moines, Iowa today, promising $125 million in housing assistance for flood-ravaged Midwestern states. Meanwhile, the Red Cross has increased its estimate of how many homes were damaged or destroyed in the floods. Joyce Russell of member station WOI reports.
At today's Flood Recovery Housing Summit, Secretary Cisneros told governors, mayors, and housing experts from 9 states what they already knew. That putting tens of thousands of displaced flood victims back into decent homes will take years. Checks were distributed to states and cities based on the number of homes damaged. Cisneros promised prompt delivery of additional aid once final damage estimates are in.
We're going to try to improve what people had from what they had before.
The Red Cross today increased to 55,000 its estimate of the number of homes damaged or destroyed by record floods. For National Public Radio, this is Joyce Russell in Des Moines.
The Pentagon today released two conflicting studies on the fitness of gays to serve in the military. The Private Rand Research report said soldiers should be required to tolerate the presence of known homosexuals, though gays and lesbians should not flaunt their orientation. The Pentagon military group said even gay men and lesbians who remain in the closet could hurt military effectiveness because their sexual behavior could constitute a high risk for AIDS. The United Nations today lodged a protest with Israel's envoy over a shooting incident in the Gaza Strip. UN officials claim the UN medical staff were wounded by an Israeli border policeman firing rubber bullets. German counterintelligence officials said today Russia's spy network is pursuing the same policies as the now-abolished KGB. In a report to the German government, counterintelligence agency also cites rising rightist and leftist violence and plotting by foreign extremists in Germany. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. Most of the stories about public schools these days are about guns, dropout rates, and falling test scores. Today on Fresh Air, a success story. My guest is Deborah Meyer, founder and co-director of the Central Park East Secondary School in East Harlem. Since the mid-70s, she's been applying her innovative ideas about learning to schools in New York City's 4th Public School District. In 1987, she received a MacArthur Award for her work. When she began to work in East Harlem, it was a district in disarray in one of the poorest parts of the city. Achievement levels were abysmal, absenteeism was high, violence and discipline problems were chronic, schools were deteriorating, and no one believed conditions could be changed. Meyer was part of a team of people who believed they could make a difference in East Harlem. They introduced school choice, developed their own curriculum, empowered the teachers, involved the parents, and the results are impressive. For example, in Meyer's high school, over 90% of the kids graduate and most go on to college. The story of Meyer School is part of a new book by Seymour Fliegel called Miracle in East Harlem. Fliegel was one of the forces behind the district's turnaround. I spoke with Deborah Meyer today about her thoughts on how children learn.
I think they mostly learn by joining the club of people who are more expert at them and what they need to learn to do. And they learn by observing, being shown, having opportunities to practice it out, getting feedback and correction. That's the way we mostly learn. We learn a foreign language by being immersed in it. And now it requires your imagining that you are going, that you could do that. You have to see yourself as a person, as the kind of person who could join that club. I often tell the story that my brother and I used to go to see baseball games all the time when we were children. And I learned a lot, as much as he did, about baseball. But he watched the game as a potential player. He saw himself as a baseball player. And he actually learned a lot about how to play baseball by watching it. And I didn't learn a thing about how to play it by watching it, because I never saw myself as the kind of person who might be a baseball player. When you read, you learn a lot. You mostly learn how to write by reading, but not if you don't imagine yourself as an author. But if you read with the eyes of an ear of an author, that's how you mostly learn to be a writer. And then you need feedback. You need an audience, an authentic response to it, which is what the teacher or other colleagues of yours can be to your writing. So you need an environment in which you can make mistakes, lots of mistakes, and in which you're not only afraid to make mistakes, but that you take it for granted that people expect you to make mistakes and that they also expect that you're going to get to be good at it. Every novice adult, child, in short, is expected to grow up. You know, I have grandchildren now, some of whom are in diapers. We know they're going to get out of diapers, and not by shaming them or giving them grades or so forth. They're going to get out of diapers because they see around them people who aren't wearing diapers, and they too think that as they get older, they'll use the toilet.
Well,
that's nature.
If we were to walk through Central Park East Secondary School, what would we see? What would the school look like? What would it sound like?
Now, of course, I've been describing an elementary school, and I should tell you that we had an elementary school for 10 years before we thought we'd had not only one but three elementary schools in District 4 before we thought about the question of high schools. And because we figured it was hard to break traditions in elementary school, harder still in high school. And so in 1985, we had the courage to take the next big jump and think what would it be like if you designed a high school with the same thing in mind. And we designed our high school with a kindergarten teacher's mindset. to make sure it was interesting. So if you went around there, you would see, first of all, adults who are talking with kids, talking with each other, kids who are talking with each other, kids who are working on computers and writing articles and looking up material and revising their work, who are in small committee meetings. You would see a conference table with 10, 15 kids sitting around it, reading the same book together, and an adult might be leading them in a seminar about that book and asking them to look more carefully at different passages. You would see sometimes kids in a more traditional lecture style where a teacher is demonstrating something or presenting some new material to them, and students are taking notes. You would see kids in laboratories working at experiments.
Would it look busier, even more chaotic than a typical public school?
It would look, if you weren't used to it, it would look, you might say, well, but where are they learning? And sometimes we have adults, we have tons of visitors, so there are some adults who are not accustomed to thinking about how we do learn as human beings, so we'll ask, well, where are they, when do they do the learning? But most adults coming in recognize immediately that this is learning activity, that this is hardworking students. In fact, one of the expressions of our school is we want the student to be the worker, not just the teacher. And in the average school setting, after kindergarten, that is, the teacher does all the work, or nine-tenths of the work, and the student is largely a passive recipient. The hardest activity is being done by the teacher. We want to reverse it. We want the hardest working activity, the most intellectually serious work, to be going on by the student. And the teacher is mostly the listener. They're trying to hear what it is the student still doesn't get. And then they're trying to devise a way to reorganize things so that, ask the right question or put the right piece of material in their hands or find the other student who might be able to prod this person to looking again at what they've done so that they might see where it really ought to be going.
I want to talk about the relationship between teacher and student. The way you've talked about some of your ideas of education, it seems that that's a very important relationship. What are you trying to promote?
Well, we think most learning is relationships. You know, human beings, as a human species, is very terrific at relationships. We're born into them, and we learn through, as I said, novices looking at it, more at experts. So the expert's job is to be a coach, if you want, to observe well and try to think about what about that performance needs improvement and then to give the kind of feedback. You can think of it in a performing arts or sports model. I often think of sports models, but, you know, if you're watching someone dive, you can make a list of all the things they did wrong, and you know that they're going to get up there again and make the same dive. Or you can think about what would be the next thing I might mention to them. I might have them look at the way their feet are pointed. But you need to know a lot about diving to know, well, if I tell them to concentrate on this, will that change the way they enter the water? So you bring your expertise and understanding of the task to try to give them a picture of what they're doing and some suggestions about where they might take it next.
Do you have classrooms with children of mixed abilities, the quote-unquote
yes.
slow learners with the
yes.
medium and fast learners?
Yeah, and we have a wide range of ages in one class, so we're lucky to have at least two age groups together and a wide range of abilities.
Do slow learners slow others down?
You have to worry about that and think about that. So I won't say to you that that's not a risk. But when we know how to do it well, they not only don't slow down, but they are useful in the intellectual life of the classroom.
Describe that, because I have a feeling that's important.
Well, first of all, because frequently they have to talk out, though. If a kid who doesn't understand things, often clarifying it for that kid helps the kid who understood it fast but didn't understand it deeply. Who caught on, you know, this kind of superficial catching on. You always get the right answer. But the slower kid slows you down to stopping to think. You know, it's like being a teacher. When I taught kindergarten kids, things I realized I didn't really understand, but I knew how to do, or I knew how to give the right answer, but never thought about them. You know how little kids ask you a question, why is this? And it elaborates and helps you understand something you never thought about before. Ooh, that. So what we call slow kids are often asking questions that irritate us precisely because the question is really, we've skipped over that step. step, and we didn't stop to ask it. So they bring an intellectual contribution to the class. And the other reason is that the kid who's trying to answer their question has to be articulate. He has to try to think why he knows the answer. And in doing that, he learns a lot about his own thinking.
Do you see yourself then educating future workers, future thinkers? What about the three R's, and what kind of curriculum do you have?
I care a lot about the three R's. In the sense that I care that they have a lifetime of reading ahead of them. And therefore, when I say the three R's, I mean I want to make readers of them.
Mm-hmm. Readers, readers, readers.
Readers, readers, readers. Writers, writers, writers. Mm-hmm. And
arithmeticers.
People who know how to think abstractly and symbolic. Because those are very powerful tools, and people with power in society are people who are adept at that. And I want a society full of powerful people who know how to use their minds well. So my model, in a way, is to think about the powerful citizen. But I think we're more and more concluding that the kinds of qualities that make for powerful citizenship, in fact, also make for powerful employees and family members. And in the long run, collectively make for a powerful society. So we're kind of, in that sense, at a happy moment. It's not a happy moment in lots of ways in the world we're in, but we're in a happy moment in which we've concluded that it would be a good idea if more people in this world had the qualities that have always gone with the classiest of educations.
I'm speaking with educator Deborah Meyer. Her work in New York public schools is profiled in the book Miracle in East Harlem. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Deborah Meyer, founder and co-director of the Central Park East Secondary School in East Harlem. How do students get into the school?
Well, first of all, we have three elementary schools, and we fill half of our seventh grade by graduates of our elementary school, some of whom don't go on to other schools and some of whom stay with us. And the other half largely come from District 4 schools, which, as you know, is a district that has schools of choice. And so they select this as the school. And we try to keep a very heterogeneous, mixed population so that while the school is overwhelmingly Black and Latino, we have some kids who are academically competent and some kids who are really still struggling with competence. We have 20% of the kids are has what they're called special educational needs.
Do you accept every child who chooses the school?
No, but we accept them on the basis of a district system, which is first you'll go through the first choices. And then we accept if we have more boys, let's just making it up, we have more boys than girls, we will just use a lottery to pick. They have to visit the school, though. They have to visit so that they know what they're getting into. In our high school, for example, you can't graduate our high school until you to demonstrate in a fairly rigorous way that you have met our graduation standards. And I don't care how many English courses you pass, math courses. We don't do it by course credit. We do it by an agreed-upon school-wide set of standards for written work, for mathematical work, for performance in the outside world, and a whole series. We have 14 what we call portfolios a student has to demonstrate and then defend before a graduation committee, which includes faculty, students, and outsiders.
By being a choice school, do you get a more committed student body?
I don't think so, but I think once they're making a choice helps create a commitment. Kids, when they start off at the beginning of every year, degree to which most kids believe of the possibility that they'll make it. It's always one of the touching qualities in all schools in the beginning of school year is that they've gone out and bought their new little books and they've got their pencils sharpened and they come into school And there is a moment in which they're back to being like first graders, and they it usually goes away very fast. Like this year they're going to do their homework in time. This year they're going to be successful. looking at the histories of the kids we get in our school, a great many of them have had 4, 5, 6, 7 years of nothing but defeat. And they come in that same hopeful way, and it isn't as easy. It's not a miracle. I think all of us who start schools were, you know, new schools, like all of us in District 4 who started our own schools, some part of us thought that if we could just do it our way, it would all be easy and the kids would all be wonderful and they would all do the homework on time and they would all behave nicely and we'd never have a discipline problem again. Central Park East is not Nirvana. Kids still behave badly sometimes. We still have to sometimes get sent to me, the principal, to deal with. I still have to call parents and say, what in the world are we going to do? Come in, we got to talk. There are kids who forget to do their homework day after day and drive teachers crazy. I mean, all those things still happen. Kids bring a lifetime of bad habits and test us out all the time to see whether we're strong enough adults to put up with them and see that the work that they need to do is accomplished.
But does choice make a difference? And I would think,
yes,
as an outsider, that in a way you're going to get students whose parents or who they themselves have thought about the kind of school they want to be involved in, have even perhaps thought about
their
future.
Every kid in our district has to make a choice.
Right. Because you have choice
within the district. Every sixth grader has to make a choice of a seventh grade school. Right. So that is a help. But it's also true, I would say, schools of choice in New York City often got the kids who were the most troubled, to whom this was the most desperate measure. So, you know, I think of my own three children, which they just went to the local neighborhood school. But I had one kid who was the most troubled of my three. And he's now a teacher and a wonderful one, but he found going to school the hardest, and he found everything in life the hardest. And he's the one who began to think, maybe there's another place. You know, as parents, we do the most convenient thing we can first. And if it doesn't work, then we worry about what else do we do next. And if there's no other alternatives, we turn off and get numb to it. I rarely have met a parent, and I've been working in poor neighborhoods for 25 years, and I know all the talk about how the parents are the problem. I have never met a parent who didn't deeply care, whom their children was not the most important thing in their life. They become despairing if nothing they do is powerful or effective or useful, and then it's useful. It's not. They, like all of us, they get sort of numb to it and cynical and angry at the school, and they turn off the school. They don't see any reason to show up because they can't see any way in which their showing up will be helpful. We spend a lot of time in our school trying to think how to help parents be more powerful by our thinking about what messages we send. Do we send messages to parents that help them to do something more powerful, or do we just complain about the kid? It's no point in going to school and just hearing how bad your kid is.
Let me ask you another question about choice, whether you think that it is part of the solution of the problem of public education, whether it can be used prescriptively to deal with some of the problems of poor academic performance, of behavior problems, all the problems that all schools are dealing with these days.
I don't think choice by itself will solve anything whatsoever. I think, on the other hand, it's a very important tool to help us. And if you just say the schools are going to remain as they are and we'll give kids choices, and we'll give schools choices also about who they take, you'll have a tracking system among schools, and nothing much will change. Big deal. And as always, the least powerful families will have the least choices. But if, on the other hand, what you're saying is, listen, we're going to create schools that have more autonomy. We're going to make schools smaller and more cohesive. We're going to give faculty also a choice about where they teach. And we're going to demand of them that they set standards and tell us what we should expect of them in their schools, and we're going to hold them to those standards, then we're going to get a lot of schools that are very different from each other. And then we have to give parents choices. But if the schools are all more or less the same, except that some of them are better and some of them are worse, then it's not fair to give people a choice.
These schools are small. Do they cost more to educate the students?
There's disputes about whether they cost more or less. I think that they certainly don't cost less, and they could be run on the same amount of money. Since more money, we could use more money. I hesitate to say that.
Right.
But per graduate, they're a bargain. Mm. You know, it's like saying, could we, I found a way to build an automobile much cheaper. Of course, the only thing is it doesn't run. We're not really counting the cost of American education in the way it needs to be counted. If we ask ourselves how many kids are graduating and how many of those who are graduating are well-educated, then the cost of American education is really quite a bit higher than we think it is. And then the cost of a good school is quite a bit lower than we think it is.
What, though, does money have to do with learning?
It produces the environment where you can have those kind of relationships. That's one thing.
Do you need a fancy environment?
You don't need, there's lots of things you don't need, but there are things that send messages. So if I hire you for a job and I have a toilet that doesn't work and I don't have any light and I make you trip over things, well, you can do your job. But I've sent a message, probably, of disrespect if down the hall they have all those things. So it's a dilemma, society. Lots of things could be done, and sometimes schools do amazing things in the most unbelievably deteriorating conditions. And I know a wonderful school that's now moved called the Brooklyn New School. And the Brooklyn New School had one broken toilet for 200 kids. And it didn't have an office that was used the hallway, and the rooms were small. And it was the most wonderful place. But after 3 or 4 years, the staff and the parents began to feel like they were being abused. I don't know if you know. They felt taken advantage of. It was so much more work to make that place cheerful. And why was it being done to them? And since these were many kids who were in otherwise disadvantaged, it's like all of us. Why do we want a nicer home? Why do we want to fix up our garden? So is it necessary? No. But I think it's something we need to ask ourselves. Why is it seem important to do for some kids and not others?
I have one very quick question for you. School starts in a couple of weeks. Are there certain things you do to get ready?
Oh, yes.
You sharpen your pencils?
Oh, you fix your room. First of all, I do lots of talking. I mean, we with the staff in our schools all get back a few weeks early because we have tons of things we want to say to each other and talk about what we're going to do this year. Then we want to fix up our rooms and we want to plan the day. We want to go over what the rules and regulations should be. And we want to look at the standards again. And we want to call a few kids in a little early. And there are a few parents we want to check things out with. And we want to make sure the books we have are the ones we wanted to have. And it's an exciting moment coming back together. And on this Monday and Tuesday, we're all going to go away. Our whole staff's going to go away together to spend 2 days together to kind of remember what we're here for and talk about what we had in mind and look over our standards and our graduation and our governance system again and make sure it makes sense.
Well, have a good year, and thank you for joining us on Fresh
Air.
Bye-bye,
Marty.
Deborah Meyer is founder and co-director of the Central Park East Secondary School in East Harlem. Her work is part of a new book by Seymour Fliegel called Miracle in East Harlem. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. Coming up, the man who describes himself as the instigator behind such comic talents as Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, and Chevy Chase. A talk with writer, director, and sometimes actor Harold Ramis. He's not as visible as his cohorts, but he's been just as influential. He co-wrote and acted in such films as Animal House, Stripes, and Ghostbusters. He also directed Bill Murray in the film Groundhog Day, which is now out on video. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Man Without a Face, which stars a disfigured Mel Gibson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, 15 defendants, including Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, have pleaded not guilty to charges that they conspired to wage a war of urban terrorism. The Sheikh is charged under a sedition law as the leader of a conspiracy who is consulted in planning acts of terrorism. He has denounced the bombing of the World Trade Center last year in New York City and denied any involvement in an alleged plot to bomb New York City landmarks. Meanwhile, in Egypt, Islamic militants are threatening possible strikes against U.S. targets following the indictment of the Egyptian-born sheikh. Laurie Neff reports from Cairo.
A statement from El Gamal El Islamiyah reportedly warns of revenge attacks on U.S. citizens and interests inside or outside Egypt if any harm comes to the sheikh. Abdelrahman is believed to be the spiritual leader of the Gamal, blamed for most Islamic violence plaguing Egypt. The American embassy in Cairo is cautioning Americans that the action against the sheikh may be met with anger by his followers. The mission says it knows of no current credible threat, but says that scattered demonstrations or sporadic acts of violence can't be ruled out. Earlier, the foreign ministry said it had no objections to the U.S. putting the sheikh on trial, but added that its request for his extradition stands. In Egypt, Abdelrahman faces charges of inciting a violent anti-government demonstration in 1989. For National Public Radio, I'm Laurie Neff in Cairo.
In Los Angeles, the four Good Samaritans who came to the aid of truck driver Reginald Denny after he was brutally beaten in the Los Angeles riots took the stand today in the trial of the man accused in his attack. From Los Angeles, NPR's Renee Montaigne has more.
Reginald Denny's rescuers are African American, as were his alleged assailants, and they all came from the same part of South Central that was engulfed in violence the night of April 29, 1992. Their appearance on the stand today reinforced a point the prosecution has made since day one, that the black community of Los Angeles is not on trial, but rather two black men. Those who helped Denny served a second purpose as well. Under questioning from the prosecution, all four testified that they believe the truck driver would have died had they not shown up and gotten the bleeding and broken man to the hospital. Defendants Damian Williams and Henry Watson are charged with attempted murder in the Denny beating. However, since none of Denny's rescuers were there when he was attacked, none could identify his attackers, a point defense lawyers brought out in cross-examination. In Los Angeles, this is Renee Montaigne.
Weather forecasters say that Hurricane Emily will pose no threat to land for at least 2 days. The storm, with winds of up to 75 miles an hour, is expected to grow stronger as it heads toward land. It is now some 400 miles from Bermuda. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 4 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, aid workers on a UN truck convoy to Mostar were blocked from leaving a Muslim area of the city by women and children, who shouted that when they left, then soldiers would come in again. A 19-truck convoy took in food and medical supplies to some 55,000 residents of the besieged city who said that they feared for their lives if the UN personnel left. Earlier, Muslim leaders had said that the convoy could leave after UN officials accused them of holding the trucks in a military move. It was the first time that aid got through since early in June. During the night, U.S. cargo planes dropped supplies into the region when it appeared the land convoy might not get through. In Nigeria, the nation's military ruler has officially stepped down as president and commander-in-chief of the armed forces. However, NPR's Suni Khalid reports that the nation's political crisis continues.
Industrialist Ernest Shonekan was sworn in today as Nigeria's new head of state. This followed the resignation earlier in the day of President Babangida at a military parade in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Shonekan, a Harvard Business School graduate, is the head of the ruling Transitional Council, or Cabinet, which was appointed by Babangida 8 months ago. The council, which includes 5 soldiers and 8 civilians, will be an interim government for the next 16 months until democratic elections are held. However, Shonekan faces a challenge by pro-democracy groups, who organized protests this week to demand Babangida hand over power to Masoud Abiola. Abiola was the projected winner of Nigeria's presidential elections 2 months ago, but before final results could be announced, Babangida annulled the elections, claiming widespread fraud. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
NASA scientists say that they now suspect that failed transistors may have caused loss of contact with the Mars Observer spacecraft. The mission has not been heard from since Saturday, when it went silent. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Harold Ramis made his directorial debut with one of the smartest dumb movies in recent years, Caddyshack, starring Bill Murray. He followed that up with National Lampoon's Vacation. And if you look back at the comic films from the past 15 years, you'll see Harold Ramis's name attached to many of the classics. He co-wrote Animal House, Meatballs, Stripes, Ghostbusters, and Back to School. In addition to writing, directing, and producing some of these films, Ramis also acted in Stripes and Ghostbusters. For his latest directing effort, Groundhog Day, Ramis has again teamed up with Bill Murray. Murray plays a self-centered TV newscaster sent to cover the annual Groundhog Day festivities in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. He's bored with the event since he's covered it so many times before. But he gets trapped in Punxsutawney by a blizzard, and when he wakes up the next morning, it's Groundhog Day again. He's forced to relive the day over and over until he gets it right. The movie came out this past winter. It was just released on video. Ramis didn't write this script and says when he first heard about the idea, he wasn't that interested. But once he read the script, he signed on to direct. I asked him what it was about the script that got him.
Well, you hear a lot of high-concept ideas for movies. So this was posed to me as this is a story of a guy reliving the same day over and over again. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And that'll probably work for about 20 minutes. When I read the script, I found that it went into all these unexpected areas, and it really was about one person's enlightenment, you know, at the risk of turning off people who are just looking for a good time at the movies. You know, it's about a guy who finally learns to step off the wheel of karma, as it were.
Were you looking for a movie that dealt with enlightenment?
Well, it's been my quest all my life.
Really? You didn't find it in Caddyshack?
Personally and professionally. Caddyshack was enlightening. It was enriching, let's put it that way, but not enlightening.
You've said that you think your talents lie in making other people's comic ideas work, and you describe yourself as an instigator. First of all, did you say that? And if you did, how far back do you think those talents go? I mean, do you think that's kind of your original talent that you've built on?
That's pretty fair. I've said it too many times. When someone asked me if I was the class clown, I said, no, but I used to write for the class clown.
Right.
It's pretty accurate. I would sit there, terrified, afraid to do anything that would call attention to myself. I was a good student. I didn't want to get in trouble with my teachers. But I would sit next to the guy who was always in trouble, and I'd say, gee, it would be really funny if someone stood up and said this, wouldn't it? And he would be dumb enough to stand up and say it. So we'd get the laugh. You know, he'd get the laugh, and I'd give myself the credit for the laugh, and he'd get in trouble.
Well, reading about you, I found that the L.A. Times said you were the Clark Kent of comedy. Rodney Dangerfield said you were the Steven Spielberg of comedy. The Wall Street Journal said you were the Maxwell Perkins of comedy. Then I found another quote, I'm not sure who to attribute it to, where someone said that you were the Leon Trotsky of comedy.
Which is right?
Oh, you said that. Which are you?
I might be one of the great second bananas of our generation. I don't know. I think I made up the Clark Kent one myself.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah. I like the Clark Kent one. I think part of the reason I write and don't perform so often is because I have these comedy alter egos inside that So I look mild-mannered on the surface, and underneath there is a Bill Murray in there somewhere. There's a Rodney Dangerfield in there. There's a Chevy Chase longing to get out.
But it sounds like you're very happy to be the instigator, the guy behind the funny guy.
Yeah, it's kind of a relief in a way. When I look at what being the point man has done to some of my friends, you know, I think I can have a real life. Like I know Bill feels very much deprived of his real life by his success.
Are you also talking about Belushi?
I was thinking of John.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he was probably a victim of his success.
Do you feel that if you had been the front man and been a star like Belushi, that you could have gone his way too?
Easily, yeah, because I understood what was happening. It was one reason I've stayed away from an acting career is that it forces you into it. There's an obligatory narcissism about it. You have to worry. It's your job becomes worrying about how you look. How am I doing? How do I look? Do people like me? Am I good enough? And it becomes a constant series of rejections because naturally you're going to be rejected many more times than you're accepted as a performer, just in getting the work. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that's a healthy focus for people. It's probably better in the what we think of as the British system, where people are carefully trained as actors. It's a profession. They're able to separate their egos from the craft itself. Whereas here we really link people's, we confuse their real lives with their performing selves. You know.
Now, you joined Chicago's Second City Improv Theater Troupe. This was back in 1969. Were you interested in the theater back then?
Oh, yeah. I was interested in entertainment in all its forms from the time I was about 4 years old. I parked myself in front of our first TV set and just didn't get up till I had to go to school.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I just watched everything, went to the movies at least one day on the weekend, sometimes twice, and those were the days of double features, even triple features with 25 cartoons. So I saw a lot of movies then and just gobbled up everything, you know.
Did you dream of being a certain actor? Or playing a certain part?
Oh, yeah. Well, at first, all the Errol Flynn roles, but also the Marx Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
I dreamed of being Harpo Marx. Mm-hmm. Someone reminded me today that Harpo Marx and I share a birthday. Oh. And he was like an idol to me when I was a little kid.
Did you like him just because he was so sweetly funny?
Yes, I thought he was wonderful. And the whole social orientation of the Marx Brothers, yeah, I thought was great. My father had several brothers, and I thought of my father and his brothers as the Marx Brothers. They had similar background, you know, Jewish immigrants and lower middle class, you know, thumbing their noses at the upper crust. It just seemed like a kind of populist, radical comedy for its time, you know.
And it was. Was your father and were your uncles funny?
My father is very funny, yeah. He very witty. He struck me as Groucho. So.
Now, when you joined, did you try out to join Second City, or did they invite you to try out? How did that work?
I had already taken workshops at Second City, which is a system that's been ongoing almost from the beginning of Second City. So I knew the technique, I knew the method. I'd been on stage a little, but the audition consisted of going in on a Saturday night after the regular company had done their show and actually improvising with them in front of a full house. That was the audition.
Wow.
Get up there and be funny.
And were you?
I guess it worked. He put me in the touring company, which is where I met Brian Murray, Bill's older brother, and Joe Flaherty, who I worked with many years after at Second City and on SCTV television show. So those were very valuable years to me.
If you're just tuning in, Harold Ramis is my guest. His latest movie, Groundhog Day, is now out on video. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Director, producer, and writer Harold Ramis is my guest.
Now, was National Lampoon's Animal House in any way autobiographical?
Oh, yeah. I worked with two great writers, Douglas Kenny and Chris Miller. And what we did was we basically were paid to sit in a room, and we thought we wrote down every funny thing we could remember from college. We just sat there and totally debriefed ourselves on college. We told every story we could remember, every character, and then we went into the every apocryphal story we'd ever heard, every anecdote, and we wrote it all down, and we had characters in mind, or characters started to evolve. And it just seemed to shape up very nicely once we had the plot. All these wonderful incidents fell into place.
Now, were you surprised that it became such a hit that it did?
No, we knew.
You knew you were onto something?
Oh, yeah, because no one had done it before. Doug Kenny had founded the National Lampoon along with Henry Beard and a guy named Rob Hoffman. You know, some of that Harvard arrogance was rubbing off on me at the time. I didn't go to Harvard. But, you know, here they were, fresh from creating a small publishing empire. So we began to believe that we could have a big, big effect on the established media. And no one had done it in movies. No one had given a voice to our generation. No one had represented what those college years were like. I was in college from 62 to 66, and there was no good counterculture comedy. No comedy came out of the late 60s or the peace movement or civil rights. It just wasn't funny. But we knew that there was this tremendous well of comedy from the sort of pre-Kennedy assassination college years. 63, everything stopped.
Yeah.
When Kennedy died, the fun went out of American life for at least 10 years, and sort of till Watergate got fun again.
And then we got fun again.
Yeah.
Well, there's certainly been enough Animal House clones, and it seems like Animal House, at least in the movie world, has become another word for disgusting.
Yeah, which is, you know, not fair. Because the odd thing is that people mistook the style for the content. You know, we didn't set out to do a disgusting movie. We set out to do a movie about our times, about a very important time, which had a point. I mean, it was countercultural, and that was what it was about. Everyone followed with movies that were just disgusting. So that's why I think the clones seem so thin for the most part.
You made your directorial debut with Caddyshack.
Very distinguished Caddyshack.
Bill Murray, Chevy Chase, Rodney Dangerfield. Although I have to tell you, I know so many people that say that this is their favorite movie, and these are people that have been, you know, the head of ACLU in certain cities around the country.
It's sad,
this cult favorite. Was this an idea that you thought of?
No, Brian Murray and Doug Kenny. Brian had been a caddy. In fact, Bill and Brian had worked at the same country club in Wilmette, Illinois. Bill was a greenskeeper, and Brian was a caddy. And Doug had worked in a pro shop in a country club in Chagrin Falls, Ohio. He was more of a tennis player than a golfer. And I was the poor city kid who just, you know, stood outside the fence looking in, wondering what that life was like. So it was a natural for this kind of what unfortunately became dubbed as the snobs versus slobs comedy, you know. But it was about, you know, for me it was a real, very derivative but very true to the old Marx Brothers spirit of, you know, you take the underdogs and put them in this society setting and go after Margaret Dumont and Sig Ruman.
Now, did you write Rodney Dangerfield's lines at all, or did they come spontaneously?
We wrote some. I worked with Rodney. Rodney is not an improviser. Everything must be set and very carefully set, every comma. It's almost a parody of the way he would work, but we would sit up at night and he'd say, should I say and or should I say but?
Really?
And he'd try it with and he'd try it with but. And I'd say, but sounds good, Rodney. And no, I think I should say and. I said, okay, then say and. Maybe but is better. You think but is better? So we would do that endlessly. But he has such a tremendous backlog of great jokes. They're good. They're not just old jokes.
Yeah.
They're really good jokes.
Yeah.
So he would look through his old joke files for what might be appropriate to the script, and he'd say, I used to do a joke in the 50s that might be appropriate here. And he would try it on me, and you know, half the time they worked. I'd put them right in the script.
Do you think you'll always be doing comedy?
I have ideas for films that aren't comedies. I haven't yet tested myself to see if I can maintain my interest in them for the 2 years it takes to get a film made.
What kind of ideas, though?
Oh, I have I'd like to do a historical epic, believe it or not, about the antebellum South.
Hmm.
Why?
I ask.
I love reading history. I really do. I didn't when I was in school, but as an adult, I've discovered that that's where all the real stuff is, you know. And I'm so fascinated by some of the things that actually happened. I've been reading a book by Howard Zinn called A People's History of the United States. It's kind of a radical view of American history. And I read a story that occurred during the slavery period that just fascinated me. And I won't say what it is, but it would make a wonderful picture.
But is there some comfort in doing comedy, which, of course, you've done so much and so well?
It's not like comedy is the safe alternative.
Exactly.
Comedy is terrible. I mean, you know, you've heard people say it, you know, dying is easy, comedy is hard. Who said that? I don't remember. But it's true. You know, comedy is nightmarish, trying to make people laugh. You walk out on that limb, and it can be, talk about egg on your face.
Mm-hmm. But are you afraid that if you keep doing comedy that it will become formulaic or, you know what I mean, that you won't be able to sustain the interest in it? You'll fall back on your old jokes, your old habits.
Well, I think I reached the point where it probably was in danger of being formulaic. I mean, you know, Caddyshack 2 was probably a great alarm bell for me. Not that I was so directly involved in every stage of it, but, you know, I helped launch it and worked on it to some extent. And it was such an exercise because I'd done it. And it was, talk about deja vu, you know, it was, we'd been there. And same with, to some extent, with the Ghostbusters sequel. I mean, we always asked ourselves, you know, why would we do it again? And then we ended up doing it again, and we thought we had a motivation. But the reality is, I think the challenge is to keep finding comedies that say new things, and then there's no danger of repeating what we've done before.
Harold Ramis, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been fun to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
Harold Ramis' movie Groundhog Day is now out on video. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about some of the stories they'll be covering today. Robert, what do you have for us?
Well, Marty, we'll have news of the arraignment of Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman in New York. Also, reporter Jim Zeroli on the Justice Department's apparent strategy and its indictments in the New York bombing cases. And we'll also be hearing from a reporter in Cairo about who Sheikh Omar's followers are back in Egypt. Also today, news from Jackie Rowland of the PLO emergency meeting as Yasser Arafat faces a crisis over his leadership. And Scott Simon reports on a day in the life of a Sarajevo teenager.
Robert, thanks. Those stories and more coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In Hollywood, practically everyone wants to direct, and if you're a star as bankable as Mel Gibson, you get what you want. Gibson makes his directorial debut with the new movie The Man Without a Face, and fortunately for its box office prospects, it stars none other than Mel Gibson. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
It's as though Mel Gibson were testing his fans. Do they just love him for his looks, or do they appreciate the real inner Mel? The Man Without a Face might have been a good way to find out. It's an extremely moist movie in which Gibson plays Justin McLeod, a beloved schoolteacher who's given up his career and withdrawn from the world ever since an accident burned off half his face. But only half, mind you. The other half, that is, the half that's more often on camera, is still Mel at his prettiest. Which makes for a convenient setup. While the inhabitants of the resort town where McLeod lives call him Hamburger Head and keep their distance, we, the audience, can flatter ourselves that we see his inner beauty. Because actually, we see so much of his outer beauty as well. The only other person who seems to see it is a fatherless 12-year-old named Chuck Norstad, played by Nick Stahl. He's grown up in a household full of women who think they're smarter than he is, and he wants out. What he really wants, in fact, is to go to a military academy. But to do that, he'll have to pass the entrance exam. That's when he seeks out McLeod for a little tutoring.
You still do any teaching now? The reason I ask is, this may sound crazy, but if you're still in the business, I could really use some help on an exam.
Why does that sound crazy?
I don't know. It's just that I've never thought of you as a teacher. Nobody does. Not that I know anything about you or anything. It won't take a lot of time. It's just to get into this second-rate boarding school.
Misunderstood, are we?
No, I'm just sick of living with three females, all brilliant and a family retard.
I see. Nothing at all to do with prepubescent angst, then.
Prepubescent angst? Do we detect a wee bit of pretension in the screenplay? We do. Especially when Mel and his young ward let us in on their endless Latin lessons and recitals from The Merchant of Venice. Fortunately, Gibson himself is a decidedly unpretentious screen presence. It's not just that he doesn't know how to pronounce the word angst. He also delivers a quiet and admirably subtle performance in an essentially ridiculous role, the misunderstood loner with the beautiful soul. The Man Without a Face is what happens when Dead Poets Society meets the Elephant Man. Only once we've been properly taught that our Elephant Man is not an animal, it seems there's no place for this movie to go. That's when we discover that young Chuck's mom, beautifully played by Margaret Whitten, has suddenly come into a treasure trove of information no one knew she had. For instance, she's heard that McLeod was once a child molester. And when Chuck is forbidden to see him again, an intriguing moral issue seems about to splash to the surface. Fat chance. Whenever Gibson and his screenwriter, Malcolm McCreary, can take the easy way out, they do. And that goes for Gibson's ploddingly conventional directorial style as well. As an actor, Mel Gibson didn't need to play Phantom of the Opera to prove that he's more than just a pretty face. As a director, I'm afraid he turns out to be the man without a clue.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy and Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we dip into our more recent archives for a concert with Kate and Anna McGarrigle. Their first two albums have been reissued. I'm Marty Moscowane, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.